Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. If the name of St. Louis and King Bagot rings a bell, you know a lot more about early movie history than most. We'll explain in just a little bit. But first, political dysfunction. Is it just a phrase or today's political reality? It's an issue that will be discussed in detail at a conference here tomorrow titled The Ethics of Political Dysfunction: What to Do When the System Breaks Down. The conference is sponsored by the University of Missouri-St. Louis's Center for Ethics and Public Life. It will look at political dysfunction at the national, state, and local levels and will feature a keynote address by former Republican Senator Olympia Snow of Maine. Joining me to discuss the issue of political dysfunction are Wally Sewart, the director of UMSL's Center for Ethics and Public Life. Conference participant Dr. Laurel Harbridge is with the Department of Political Science at Northwestern University and author of the forthcoming book, Is Bipartisanship Dead? Also with us is former Missouri State Senator Tim Green, another conference participant. Thank you all so much for being with us. Nice to have you. Certainly a timely subject. Wally, let me begin with you. I think for the purposes of our discussion, we probably ought to really have a definition of what political dysfunction is. Do you have one?
I'd love to hand you a little short bumper sticker definition, but one of the reasons that we decided to do the conference was precisely because everyone complains about political dysfunction, but you ask five different people what it is and you'll get five different answers. So one of the first things we want to talk about is what exactly we mean when we talk about political dysfunction, because everyone complains about it. But we want to get a little more specific. What do you mean when you say the government isn't doing what it ought to do?
That's basically it. Laurel, do you have the same definition?
So I think I agree certainly that there are many definitions. One of the ways that I've tried to tackle this question in my own research and in the way that I talk about politics and think about things is thinking about when the incentives for focusing on places of partisanship in politics kind of outweighs the incentives for focusing on traditional means of governance in terms of passing legislation, addressing reoccurring issues, focusing on solutions to pressing problems in society.
So are we experiencing a period of political dysfunction right now in this country?
I would say that yes.
On the basis of your definition, one would have to think so.
Yes, and I think that it's somewhat unique over the course of the last 30 or 40 years in American politics to be at a point where partisanship appears to trump governance so much.
Well, let me turn to a former senator now, Tim Green, and get your slant on this, having served in the legislative process. What are your thoughts about it?
Basically, it's simple. People can't get along to do something productive and constructive for the citizens of the state. We all get elected. We're all there to serve, and our top priority should always be to the taxpayers, and it's not that difficult to get along and try to work things out. And I think you don't see that as much as you've seen it when I began my political career in the late 80s and early 90s.
What happens? What happens to cause this inability to get along?
Well, I think one of the things that has happened is term limits. The people passed a referendum vote and it went into effect in 1994. And with term limits, you only have people serving 8 years. So as soon as they are elected, they know their time clock is running 8 years. So then they are then looking for other opportunities to run. Before term limits, you had people that would serve up to 20 years. They created relationships, worked on things. And in our system of government, you do not want something passed right away. You want it vetted. Vet it with your colleagues. You want people that have worked in the industry. You always look at former teachers or former principals you served with to tell you what is needed in the classroom. So once you get it vetted, it works through the process. You get respect of each other. You acknowledge their expertise, whether they're a Democrat or Republican. And basically, at the end of the day, you get in a room and you work things out. Being one of seven children, it's no different than what my mother did when there was disagreements within us. Work it out.
Laurel Harbridge, do you buy that, or do you see something else, or a combination of things?
So I think that's certainly a factor, although that's something that plays out more often at the state level than it does at the federal level, where we don't have term limits. But I think there are a whole host of different factors that all produce incentives for politicians and for the majority party in particular to focus on places of where they can differentiate the two parties rather than focus on where they agree. So in recent years, we've had much more competition for majority control in terms of the majority party switching back and forth. So when you do that, you don't have very many incentives to point out to the public where you agree with the other side. You also have interest groups and others who give money maybe across the spectrum, but if they're going to concentrate that money, it gets concentrated at the political extremes, not in the center. Primary elections also give politicians incentives to focus on the interests of co-partisans in the public and not their broader constituency.
I want to pick up on that in just a moment with a sound clip we have of former Senator Olympia Snowe. But let me turn to Wally and get your input on what we've just been talking about before I do that.
Well, I agree with everything that's been said so far. There's a lot of disincentives to compromise kind of built into the political system that we have to deal with. I think redistricting is definitely a part of that. We've drawn districts that are so safe, for instance, that you're only going to get a challenge from an extreme end of your party as opposed to somewhere from the middle. And compromise seems to simply have become a bad political word. It seems to have been something that instead of formerly we thought of politicians as we want them to be able to work across the aisle and get something done. When we talk about politicians that work across the aisle, they seem to be politically punished for it. And I think it's a be a really interesting question to know what changed, the kind of opinion of the American political electorate toward thinking that working for compromise was a bad thing. There's a fundamental tension in government of a country. Number one, we're all one country, so there's common cause. We put together and we are kind of in the same ship and we all go the same direction no matter what one individual chose. But then, of course, if that common cause isn't so immediate, say we're not at war, we don't have some kind of external conflict or some kind of threat, then we start to fight amongst ourselves. And when that gets too much, then somehow the process breaks down. It seems like that's part of what's happening at the moment.
You know, I mentioned that we have some clips from Senator Snowe, and the primary is one issue, as Laurel has just indicated. But let's go to redistricting, which you have just brought up most recently, and hear what the senator had to say during a recent interview here on that subject.
The dynamic in the primary is what's influencing not only who gets elected in the final analysis, but also the legislative process and the atmosphere in the United States Congress, because they're more beholden to those who cast their votes in the primary, which is a much more polarizing electorate and fewer, than they are to the broader population. And therefore, they don't take the risk of working across the political aisle because they're much more responsive to those who elected them in the primary.
Former Senator Olympia Snowe, who will be a part of your conference tomorrow at the University of Missouri. Anybody take any exception to with what the senator had to say, Tim Green?
No, I agree with her. The congressional redistricting happens at the state legislative level. In the state of Missouri, we went from 9 congressional seats down to 8 congressional seats. And they're pretty much heavily partisan, all 8 of those seats. So the individual that will be elected in those congressional seats in Missouri will be selected in the primary. There was always a push to try to get some of these districts to be more 52-53% one party or the other so that you would get more competition and more people active. But when you're dictating the electorate through the primary process, you're going to elect the extremes on both sides. Then when you elect both of the extremes and then they go to Washington, D.C., what do you expect is going to happen?
And I think to that I would add that both in terms of something that's changed over time and ties together the primaries with the redistricting concerns is that in previous decades in the United States, the alignment between party ideology and who people voted for was much less well connected across the country. So in particular, you had Southern Democrats representing very conservative parts of the country. And so those members were much more concerned about the kind of general election sorts of constituents that they had, their broader constituencies. And so those electoral concerns encouraged them to find these places of bipartisan agreement. More recently, when you have most members being more concerned about primary elections than about general elections, they're again focused on places of partisanship rather than bipartisanship.
But go ahead, Wally.
And I think one of the reasons that when they're in the primary and they're so focused on the partisanship is because in primaries, the turnout is very small, and the people that turn out are the ones that are at the extreme end of the party. So I want to point the finger back at some of the people doing a lot of the complaining. We had record low turnout in this last election, and one of the reasons that the extremism is seen in the legislature, both at the state and the national level, is because that extremism is represented in the electorate that comes out to vote. A lot of the people that might be in the middle of the aisle are feeling frustrated, and therefore they leave the political process, and that makes the political process worse, and therefore they feel more frustrated. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy at some point.
So I would agree with that, and I think that it's there. I guess the difficulty is that redistricting on its own isn't really going to be the solution, because the way that the country has divided itself in terms of where people of different political identifications live means that if you're respecting things like the compactness of districts, communities of interest, and so forth, it's very difficult in many states, at least, to draw congressional districts that actually produce these 52% of one party or so forth, rather than heavily partisan districts.
But let's face it, redistricting is not likely to change, Tim, because it's the politicians who would have to affect that change. It would seem to me that they're fairly content with the way things are going these days.
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the factors. You won't see a change. One of the things that I always threw out there over the years that did not go too far was Missouri creating an open primary system, where you did not have to go into that booth and say, give me the Democratic ballot, give me the Republican ballot. You have the open primary system that they just select one candidate for each one. And then those candidates would be like a general election. The only person knowing who you're voting for is you.
Well, you know, I want to pick up on that point as well, because that's another thing that Senator Snowe said during our interview, and we'll get into that in just a moment, but I have to take this break. We're talking about dysfunction in government today in conjunction with a conference that's going to be held at the University of Missouri, St. Louis tomorrow. I'll have more on that a little bit later. My guests in studio are Wally Seward, the director of the Center for Public Life at UMSL. Dr. Laurel Harbridge is with the Department of Political Science at Northwestern University, and Tim Green also with us. He is a former senator from the state of Missouri. Back to continue this conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll be continuing our conversation on political dysfunction in just a moment. But first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Attorneys for the family of Michael Brown are urging restraint on the part of both protesters and police once a grand jury decides whether the police officer who shot Brown should face criminal charges. Attorneys Anthony Gray and Benjamin Crump held a press conference this morning outside the St. Louis County Justice Center. That's where the grand jury is meeting, and Dr. Michael Baden, who performed a private autopsy on the family's behalf, was scheduled to testify there. And U.S. Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri announced today that she will not support Harry Reid as minority leader in the Senate. She says that she has heard voters in Missouri, quote, loud and clear, and that they have said they want change in Washington. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation about political dysfunction. I was a little surprised to hear Senator McCaskill say that today, but let's see where that takes in our current Congress, where dysfunction is something that is often mentioned. Let me go back to, Senator Snowe and our conversation. Her proposals for dealing with this issue are 5-day work week for Congress. Everybody think that's a pretty good idea?
Put them to work.
Laurel, you're not quite sure there.
I think there are probably both pros and cons to it. One of the downsides is that, in that case, legislators would spend less time back in their districts. So one of the reasons that Congress shortened their work week in the first place was because constituents wanted members to be back in the district more. But I think that the upshot of it is certainly increased time to work together, increased interactions outside of Congress as well.
Well, I think part of the frustration on the part of the public and is the fact that they see these folks taking these long hiatuses from Washington when things have to get done, so nothing's getting done. I'm not sure that people necessarily want to see these Congress people back home. But anyway, that's a good point. Thank you for making. Any other?
Well, the one thing in bringing in comparison is in the state legislature, the good thing about that is we're required to accomplish everything in a 4.5-month time period. And once things aren't accomplished that year, then you have to start from scratch the following year. So we have in our Constitution, you have to pass a balanced budget by this certain date, and it's always 7 days prior to the end of session, which is normally the first Friday in May, but setting some constraints of you will have to accomplish it. Just like when being a construction worker growing up, they give you a job, they want the job complete. The taxpayers and the citizens have elected you to a job, they want you to complete it.
I think a part of the reason that she's talking about a five-day work week, as Laurel just said, is we want them spending more time together. We want them understanding each other. We want them understanding each other's issues, their problems, so that they can actually address and come to an agreement when they come to the negotiating table. It takes a long time to even just bring people together to the negotiating table, and those steps can often happen informally, and that means being in Washington together. So I think it's an important point.
Yeah, we hear a lot about the informal connection between the people in Washington in particular, not nearly what it was a generation ago, and that is part of the problem. A single primary day like Super Tuesday, where everything happens at once, good idea? Everybody's nodding affirmatively?
I think simply the idea that that would get more attention. You would have a kind of more a cohesive message to the public. It wouldn't be all broken up. Everybody knows, hey, let's make it a national holiday and let people off of work and make sure that they do get to the polls. Let's add to that. Let's make them vote. You know, in Australia, you actually get fined if you don't vote. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of different things we can think about to get the public involved.
And maybe even do it on a weekend where more people are available to vote. Oh, okay.
What a thought.
Well, one of the things Missouri has yet to do, and you can do absentee ballot. You can go to the election board and check the box, I'll be out of town, even though you won't be out of town. I think that sends the wrong signal. Allowing people several weeks before Election Day to vote. I mean, we give people a longer time period to vote for who plays in the All-Star game than we do when we're electing people who represent us in government. So making voting easy and accessible, I think, should be one of the top priorities.
She also mentions redistricting. We've talked about that and what the value of that would be. And open primaries, which is something, Tim, that you mentioned a moment ago. Open primaries, everybody thinks. Laurel?
So the only thing I would note on that is that the evidence is actually fairly weak at the state level in terms of whether state-level polarization in the legislature is different depending on whether you have open primaries or closed primaries. So the logic is there to kind of suggest that maybe it would help, but given who turns out, I think the results aren't too compelling yet that it would actually make much of a difference.
Well, Wally, go ahead.
One of the things that we do have a partisan system, and we want people to be able to draw differences between the two parties, and that's one of the things. Strangely, it's one of those weird paradoxes. The differences between the parties both drives them to the polls in terms of one side. You know, they might choose one side over the other. But when that difference gets too contentious, and I think that's an important part of what's happening right now, why open primaries might be an important choice, but when that difference gets too contentious, it actually turns them away.
Well, okay. I want to get back to Senator Snow, because the crux of the whole matter is the fact that why this is happening basically is focused on the fact that politicians want to be reelected, that first and foremost, that is their primary concern. Legislating is second. Let's hear what she has to say.
It's not remarkable that there are differences. The question is whether or not you're prepared to work with the other side to resolve those differences. And unfortunately, somehow this whole process is morphed into all about the politics and how you get elected and what's going to be in the next 30-second soundbite for the next election than it is about solving the problems for the country. And that's why the public has rightfully lost confidence, because they don't see the connection between what Congress is doing and not doing and the world in which they live on a daily basis.
Tim Green, you have a bit of a smile on your face at the moment.
Well, the thing I enjoyed about that comment was the 30-second soundbite. And maybe this is a way defending the public official, but I always enjoyed when I first ran for office, I'm a good father, I'm a good husband, and I'm a good provider, and then when I file for office, I get all these negative 30-second sound bites to say how horrible of a human being I am. And then once I'm elected, people are contacting my office asking me to come give a resolution for an Eagle Scout presentation or a 50th wedding. So you go from being a good person to being the devil and then getting elected and trying to get people once again to believe you are a human and not as negative as those 30-second sound bites. So there's some responsibility on the attack and the negative sound bites that turn the electorate off immensely as well.
Well, I wanted to bring that up, the media's role in all of this. I mean, we look at cable news in particular today, where they have these niche, what would you call them? They're not newscasts, but they're commentators and pundits who scream at each other and take very, very partisan sides. This has got to be just fanning the flames, whatever discord there might be in the legislature, Laura.
Absolutely. And scholars who have done some research in this area do seem to have evidence that when people listen to these kind of angry, uncivil sorts of exchanges in the media, that they come away from that not only feeling more committed to their side, but feeling anger at the other side. So not only do you just disagree with their positions, but now you kind of have negative affective reactions towards them as well.
Really dislike the other side. I mean, it gets that pointed, doesn't it, Wally?
Absolutely. Your political enemy turns into your mortal enemy. Yeah. We kind of confuse the idea that you're someone who, you know, I share common cause with as a citizen of this country, now all of a sudden you're the person that's trying to tear this country down. It goes from we have a difference of opinion about how this country should be run to the idea that the other side is actually wants to tear the country down. And I think that's an important part of it. The media plays a very, very important role. Our conference last year was on the ethics of politics and the press. And one of the important points that one of the presenters made was that, for instance, CNN, that's trying to kind of find that middle road. Mm-hmm. Well, if your political views are on the left side of the spectrum, you're going to see CNN as biased to the right. If your political views on the right side of the spectrum, you're going to see CNN as biased to the left. And now nobody's watching CNN, which kind of bears itself out in what's been happening in the market. So it's really difficult to know how to address those issues.
Any other thoughts on that,
Tim? One of the things when I was serving in the Missouri Senate, there used to be an old unwritten rule that when you were a sitting senator, you wouldn't raise money and push for candidates against one of your colleagues. And the idea was that is how can you work with someone, then in the off-year election, you're raising money so that negative things are said about them. The trust factor then is lost, and trying to get something accomplished becomes hateful instead of productive.
The raising money part of it brings in a whole other aspect of this whole equation and the role that it plays, the big money, since Citizens United and the Supreme Court ruling. That, too, is playing a role, is it not, Laurel?
So the evidence so far on the big money post-Citizens United is still a bit clear because it's always very difficult to know what's actually being changed by money because you often have a lot on both sides. But I think it certainly provides some of the incentives for politicians to focus on the places of partisan disagreement, because most of the money comes from a direction in which they support one side overwhelmingly and provide very little support to the other side.
Then regardless of their message, they now have the money in most cases to pound away at it on television, where this whole flame gets rekindled or gasoline thrown on it.
And Missouri is one of those states we've got a perfect trifecta. We have absolutely no limits on campaign contributions, no limits on lobbyist gifts, and no revolving door law, which means legislators walk out one day as legislators and walk back in as lobbyists the next, which just makes it really difficult to try to get past that money issue.
Right. I want to get to something else, but we have a caller here I'd like to bring in before we get too far away from the redistricting issue. So let's bring in Bill calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Bill.
Well, this is such a great show about my favorite issue, one of my favorite issues, redistricting, and I hope my comment is relevant. I've been trying to follow the discussion. Missouri's a purple state. We have Democratic statewide office holders, but a very Republican legislature, and that seems to be because of redistricting. And so I've been lately advocating people to try to get an initiative petition on the ballot in 2016, a constitutional amendment for independent redistricting, like California and some other states do, and both for statewide offices as well as federal. And it really seems to me that people of both parties would welcome independence in that sort of redistricting and a more balanced legislature that would be able to work together. And I hope it becomes a popular idea. And I was wondering what your panelists thought of it.
Okay, let's ask them, Bill. Thank you for the call. I'll start with you, Wally, and work around.
Independent redistricting is definitely something that's gotten a lot of attention around the nation. California, as you mentioned, has begun a little experiment there, and I think the jury's still out on how that's actually working. I think some of the points that Laurel brought up are really interesting is we're not just dividing ourselves politically, but we're dividing ourselves geographically in this country into kind of areas of interest and areas of like belief. So it's sometimes going to be hard to draw those districts correctly, but now I do think that it's hard, but it's going to be a lot easier to come closer to an ideal district if it's an independent unit that's doing that rather than a partisan process.
I think one of the other challenges of drawing district boundaries and thinking about what types of districts you get depending on who is the group drawing those boundaries is when a unified partisan control of a legislature is drawing the district boundaries, you often end up with district boundaries that pack the opponents into districts, so wasting votes, and create districts that favor by, you know, a little bit over a majority but don't waste too many votes in their districts. One of the potential downsides of either the more divided government scenarios or even the independent commissions is that you may end up with more incumbent protecting redistricting plans that don't actually do anything to help the extent of polarization and partisanship.
I think the biggest issue is the devil's in the details. If you look at Missouri, the last two times, 2002 and 2012, our commission process of redistricting did not work and it was thrown into the courts. So creating a citizens commission is all in the details. But to help this individual, if they go that route, I'd just like to add, you ought to consider, too, is downsizing the Missouri House from 163 to 103 state representatives. And I think that could assist you in getting the issue passed because that's been an issue for years as well.
Time is slipping away from us. I do want to bring in one other point here before we have to say goodbye. The title of your conference tomorrow at UMSL, which is happening all day long at UMSL, and I guess anyone is invited who wants to come by, willing.
You can register at cepl.umsl.edu.
We'll put a link on our website at stlpublicradio.org. But the title is The Ethics of Political Dysfunction, What to Do When the System Breaks Down. Has it broken down?
That's an excellent question. You talk to some people and they think, hey, a political process that doesn't create a whole lot of laws is actually a good political process. You talk to others and they say, no, the government needs to play a larger role in a lot of things that are going on in society these days. I do think that it's pretty difficult to deny at this point, given, for instance, the lack of a budget at the federal level, given, for instance, you know, a lot of the priorities that we know the American population thinks are important, immigration reform, et cetera, that simply aren't getting addressed. Has it broken down, period? I think that's a tougher question. Is there a rising level of dysfunction? Absolutely.
All right. Laurel, has it broken down?
I guess I'll have to echo the same sentiments of my colleague here. I think it's certainly – I don't think it's a absolute in either one sense or the other, but I think it's certainly – politics has changed in a way that even over the last decade that politicians were able to make sure that things got done, both on these reoccurring things like budgets and pressing issues, even back in the 1990s with divided government between the Republicans and Clinton in a way that you don't see today.
Right. And Tim?
Let me leave it on a positive note.
Good.
Last year, you had the governor in the Republican-controlled legislature along in Missouri, along with the Democrats, all work within about a three-year period to bring an economic development policy for Boeing to try to bring them to St. Louis. So to leave it on a positive note, you did see everyone working together over a three-week span to try to better the state of Missouri. So.
Okay. My negative note is the recent vote showed a very low voter turnout, and that says an awful lot to me and I think to a lot of people, too, with regard to their regard for politics and politicians. I want to thank you all so much for being with us. Wally Seward, thank you for being with us. Hope you have a great conference tomorrow. Loyal Harbridge, thank you for being with us. Welcome to St. Louis. And Tim Green, thank you so much for being with us. Have a good conference. And we're going to be talking about an actor I'll bet you never heard of before. Or a St. Louis actor who was a big, big superstar. That's coming up in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.